Welcome to Political Perspectives on KBOO. My name is John Schuck. I'm speaking with Penpa Sering. Penpa Sering is the new representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. He was elected to this post in May of 2016. Previously, he was a member of the Tibetan Parliament in exile, where he served as Speaker since 2011. On December 7th, he addressed the Congressional Executive Commission on China on Capitol Hill regarding human rights issues. He was in Portland over the weekend, meeting with Portland's Tibetan community. He stopped by KBOO to speak about Tibet, human rights, and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Welcome, Penpa Sering, to the United States and to Portland.
Thank you so much. It's good to be in Portland.
Tell me a little bit about your role as representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet in Washington. What will you do?
As representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I also focus on the visions of His Holiness. His Holiness always says that being one human being out of the 7.4 billion human beings on this world, he is just an ordinary human being and a Buddhist monk. So he promotes moral values, which is deteriorating around the world, and all these problems among younger generation and, you know, between people, between different races, and between different issues, you know, stems from the lack of education in on moral values in the schools, because school curriculums these days are focused more on materialism and too much into individualism. That is one the most important vision of His Holiness. And the second is, as a Buddhist monk, he's a religious person, so he promotes interreligious harmony. The very reason why religion is in this world is to promote more peace and compassion and love amongst people, amongst different living beings, and in harmony with nature. But on the other hand, these days, religion is also becoming a tool for violence, for killings among the same fraternity, you know, coming from the same God or the prophet, you know, people are still killing in the name of religion. So His Holiness strongly believes that religion should be a force to bind people, to bring more of all the basic teachings that all the religions teach: more love, more friendship, more compassion. But so instead, since it's going the other way around, His Holiness meets with leaders from different religious faiths and organizes those kind of conferences, and, you know, be an example to the people for interreligious harmony. And third, since he's a Tibetan, then he has the responsibility for the Tibetan people, for the Tibetan issue to be resolved. So that part, and also His Holiness also has been working with scientists for a very long time, for more than three decades, on particularly relating Tibetan Buddhism with psychology, which is a highly developed, studies conducted by Indian masters way back for more than 2,000 years. And these are still very relevant. And also on quantum physics and neuroscience. These are very, very related to Buddhism. And Buddhism, in fact, has much, much more lead than modern science in these areas. So he's trying to connect science and religion.
And he wrote a book, the Universe and an Atom, I believe.
Yes.
It was. Yes,
that's
yeah,
true.
I read that. Yeah.
Well, that's very, very, very similar to what science says about human evolution. Yeah.
Your role is to be a spokesman for him and for his positions?
So work in these areas, not very directly, but to facilitate, you know, meet with people from these areas and see how we can work together. But my role is also that of the representative of Central Tibetan Administration, which is the administration of Tibetans in exile. So we have to represent the Tibetans in Tibet as to what is happening inside Tibet, and make these things known to the outside world, and also work for the welfare of the Tibetans in exile. And in that sense, our office also have to work with the White House whenever there is a meeting between the United States President and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And in the same way, also with the Prime Minister's office in Canada, then we have to work with the State Department. There is a 2002 U.S. Tibet Policy Act passed by the Congress, and the act provides that the administration appoints a special coordinator for Tibet in the State Department. As of today, it is undersecretary level, Ms. Sarah Sewell. And in the new administration, we don't know who would be. We still don't know who the Secretary of State is going to be. And maybe once the Secretary of State's post is filled, we'll know who the Deputy Secretary and Undersecretary would be, and particularly someone who would be coordinating on the Tibet issue. Then we also have funding aids from USAID, from PRM, Population, Refugees and Migration for the Tibetans. And there are also some scholarship programs funded by the State Department for the Tibetans. So we have to liaise with the State Department. Then we also have to work with the Congress in both the Senate and the House to gain support for the Tibet, to raise the issue of Tibet in the Congress. So we have to meet with a lot of leaders in Congress and staffers in the Congress. And then apart from that, of course, we have a growing number of Tibetans in North America. The total number of Tibetans in exile is about 150,000. And out of that, estimatedly about 25,000 Tibetans are in North America, both U.S. and Canada included. And that is roughly 16% of the Tibetan population in exile. And this number is going to grow. So, and they are all scattered in some 30 different states in U.S. and Canada, mostly in U.S., about 24 of them. And this is also the reason what brings me to Portland.
Tell me about that. Why Portland specifically?
Portland, we have a vibrant community of 300, 400 Tibetans living here. They are very well organized. In fact, they are... There may be the one or two Tibetan associations who are very independent now. They have their own community center with the help of non-Tibetan Americans who helped initially, and the Tibetans also worked very hard to get the community center, which is debt-free, and they also have become now very... good or contributing part of the community, American community in Portland. You don't find too many Tibetans who are jobless, who are unemployed. Everyone does contribute to the society, to the community that they live in. But at the same time, being Tibetans, they also try to preserve their own identity by learning Tibetan language, culture, and religion. Which has the potential to spread more peace and compassion in this world.
On December 7th, you spoke to the Congressional Executive Commission on China on Capitol Hill, and you gave a six-minute speech to the commission. And I want to talk about that in just a second. But before we get to that, tell us a little bit about Tibet. The area is actually quite large, nearly a quarter of China's landmass. Tell us a little bit about the geography and the people of Tibet.
Tibet, some people believe that Tibet is a very small country, like Bhutan or something, but it's a huge country nestled in the north of Himalayas, that is north of India. It has about 2.13 million square kilometers, which is roughly 30 times the size of Austria. And but we are sparsely populated. We used to call ourselves, our land, the land of cool climb, or land surrounded by snow mountains, because we are, the whole of Tibet is surrounded by, you know, Himalayas in the west, Karakoram, and the Himalayas on the south, Karakoram on the west, Kunlun in north. And you know, Tibet has the average altitude of Tibet is about 24,000 to 25,000 above sea level. So Westerners started calling Tibet as the roof of the world, as the highest plateau on the world. And the Asians called Tibet as the water tower of Asia, or the source of Asian rivers. And now, these days, the Chinese environmental scientists call Tibet as the third pole.
The third pole.
North Pole and South Pole. Tibet has the largest amount of glaciers and permafrost that feeds all these major rivers that goes into Pakistan, India, Nepal, into Bangladesh, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and into China. The two big rivers that go into China, the Yangtze and the Yellow, also originate from Tibet. So some estimate that some 30% of the world population, you know, the areas where Tibetan rivers flow are most densely populated areas in the world. So some people estimate that 30% of the world population has something or other to do with rivers that originate from Tibet. So environmentally, not just the political issue of Tibet, only for the Tibetans, but environmentally, it is vitally important for the whole region. It has the climatic conditions on Tibet has a lot of consequences on monsoons in India, or, you know, the jet streams that flow over the Tibetan plateau also has a lot of implications on climatic conditions in many of the neighboring countries. So,
in a sense, the Tibetan people are protectors in many respects, and so there's a risk without stability there of the protection of the environment itself.
We have been living on that land for centuries, you know, since time immemorial, and we have learned to live with nature harmoniously. Now, with the occupation of Tibet by the Communist Party of China, you call China today as the factory of the world. And when they can go as far as Africa and Latin America for natural resources to feed all these factories, why not Tibet? But till 2007, when they built a railway across the Tibetan plateau from Qinghai, you know, to Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, linking to the mainland China, which at one time people thought it's technologically not possible to do that. But China built that over permafrost and, you know, all that. And now more and more Chinese are coming in, and it has become much more viable for China to, you know, excavate or exploit Tibetan natural resources, because Tibet was a virgin land. And now they can carry Tibetan, they can bring in more Chinese into Tibet, which is demographic aggression, and take out Tibet's natural resources. So this, and that too, all this exploitation of Tibet's natural resources, they don't do a feasibility study or environmental impact study as to, you know, what could be the adverse consequences on Tibetan plateau of the human activities that the Communist Party of China is undertaking inside Tibet.
Well, what are some of the specific things that China is doing? Are they mining?
Yeah, north of Tibet, in my father's region called Amdo, they have uranium and mercury and copper and a lot of other, and some parts of central Tibet are also known for gold and things like that. So for these factories, they also divert rivers. And mercury, you know, the residues of mercury rest on the river bed that affects the health of people in downstream countries. And China is also building a lot of dams on the Mekong River that originates from Tibet. Till it reaches the boundary of Burma, they have built or dams are being built. Some 32 dams are on that river alone. And now Brahmaputra, which is one of the longest rivers that originate from inside Tibet, but west, northwest of Tibet, into India and Bangladesh, which goes into the Bay of Bengal, they also now more and more building of dams are coming up. And at this place called the Great Bend, where the Brahmaputra flows east and then suddenly takes a U-turn and comes south into India and Bangladesh, the China is planning to build a dam that is bigger than the Three Gorges Dam, which is the biggest in the world. And all these places are seismic zone. You have witnessed, earthquake in Afghanistan. That's the beginning of the Himalayas in that region, to Nepal and, in parts of Tibet. So if something happens to that size of a dam, what could be the consequences for the people living downstream is unimaginable. And the level of the number of dams that are being built, they're also thinking of diverting river waters up north into the parched area of China. South is a little bit better, but north is getting parched because China needs a lot of water to feed that kind of population and also agricultural usage. So these are very, very dangerous. Today we are political refugees, but another 30, 40, 50 years down the line, there might be so many environmental refugees, people having to shift their livelihood from the river water system to other sources of livelihood, which may not be suitable to them or not being able to adapt so quickly. So that's a real danger.
You're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm John Shuck. My guest is Penpa Tsering, the representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. He was in Portland over the weekend. The conversation continues after this on Political Perspectives. This is KBOO. Sound of unity. Some of the lyrics are, O Tibetans, unite, unite. If you think about the sadness of your father, unite, unite. Three provinces, unite. This is KBOO. You're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm John Shuck, and I'm speaking with Penpa Tsering, representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. Can you give us a history of Tibet, especially since 1949?
Tibet has a recorded history of more than 2,200 years. And during this whole period, at least there was a time in between 8th to 10th century when Tibet was a big empire, along with Mongol and Chinese empire. And at that time, we even conquered the capital of China called Xi'an and also imposed a titular puppet emperor. But then Tibet disintegrated after 10th century for two, three centuries. And then the Mongol influence came in Asia when Mongolia was becoming a big empire. Even before Mongols invaded China, Tibet came under its influence. But there was never, ever direct interference by the Mongols in running Tibet. And we developed a very unique relationship with the Mongols, who started turning Buddhist. So we became the teachers of Buddhism to the Mongols. Even today, Mongolians look at the Dalai Lama as a spiritual teacher. You must have witnessed this from the last visit of His Holiness to Mongolia. And there's a huge link. The fourth Dalai Lama was also born in Mongolia. So this historical link made us the spiritual leader of the Mongols, and the Mongols became our protectors, political and, demographic protectors. So this relationship eventually also transferred on Chinese Buddhist emperors, the Manchus who ruled China for several centuries, and then the Chinese emperors. So this relationship continued as priest and patron relationship between the Tibetans, Mongols, Tibetans, Manchus, and Tibetans, Chinese who ruled China. But Tibet was never, ever directly administered by any country directly. So when communism was taking over the whole of the world, starting from Europe to, you know, Soviet Union, and then to China, and then when it started enveloping Tibet also, because we became part of the great game. And the British India in 1903 and 04 invaded Tibet up to the capital, and then they retreated. There was a unwritten understanding between, because the Russians were very fearful that British India would come up north through Tibet. And so in that great game of the big empires or colonialists or imperialists those days, Tibet became a victim of Communist Party of China. And then Communist Party started invading Tibet in 1948, 49, 50. And then we were forced to sign a 17-point agreement in 1951. If not, we were threatened to be invaded by force. And we signed that, and we tried to live under that agreement for 8 years, from 1951 to 58. But then Chinese renegated on all the provisions of those articles, the 17-point articles. And then His Holiness was forced to flee to India as a refugee in 1959. So since then, we are an occupied country under the Communist Party of China.
And you have an exile government in India.
We call ourselves the Central Tibetan Administration. We don't call ourselves the exile government. But then Indian leaders and world politicians call us the Tibetan government in exile. So we make a differentiation there, because Chinese also call us Tibetan government. We don't recognize the Tibetan government in exile. So whereas we call ourselves the Central Tibetan Administration. So we have our own parliament, which was started way back in 1960, just 1 year after we came into exile. You can imagine the logistics and the situation and circumstances those days. When we first came into exile in 1959, when His Holiness crossed over the Indian border on 31st March 1959, some 85,000 Tibetans followed him or preceded him. And we were put up in three transit camps in the state of West Bengal and Arunachal Pradesh in northeast of India. And the climatic conditions, people were not used to the Indian climatic conditions, which were very hot in those areas. And we were not used to Indian way of living or diet and the language and all those. So some little more than 300, 400 people died because of diet problems. And we were slowly put up in the foothills of Himalayas, because the only thing we knew was hard labor. And our people, my parents and some people's grandparents, worked on the road construction in those areas in the foothills, because climatic conditions were a little more suitable. And then the Prime Minister of India asked all the chief ministers, because land is still a state subject in India. And in South India, where I was born, in a place called Balakupi, that was the first Tibetan resettlement project in 1960, because the chief minister of that state had met with His Holiness in 1956 when His Holiness came to India for the 2500th birth anniversary of the Buddha. So then slowly, today we are put up in 10 different Indian states in some 45 different locations, big and small, some as big as 16,000 people and some as small as 200, 300 people. And the main livelihood is dry farming, agriculture of 1 acre per person. Now the population has grown up, so we don't even have one person, 1 acre. But the supplementary income comes from selling winter clothing during winter in many parts of India. So that's how we survive. So out of the 150,000 Tibetans in exile, about 90,000 are in India,
okay.
A little more than 20,000 in Nepal, a few hundreds in Bhutan, between 13 to 15,000 in whole of Europe. Estimated there about 25,000 in whole of North America. We still have an ongoing immigration program in Canada. And we also have ongoing immigration program with Australia. So you find a little more than 3,000 Tibetans in Australia. But the rest of the Tibetans, 150, 30, you find them in some 37 different countries.
And still about 6 million are in Tibet itself.
That's right. So, yeah, before 2008, we used to receive anything between 3,000 to 3,500 Tibetans from Tibet. Mostly crossing the Himalayas during winter when there is less patrol and a lot more snow, but it's also very risky. Sometimes you get shot by patrol and sometimes you lose your fingers and toes because of frostbite, and most of them are kids to get education in exile. So they stay back not knowing whether they will ever meet their family again or not. So these are very difficult circumstances. Then there was widespread peaceful demonstration in the whole of Tibet in 2008, not just the Tibet Autonomous Region, which China designates as Tibet, but in all other Tibetan areas outside Tibet Autonomous Region in Qinghai Province, which are traditionally Amdo area, and other Sichuan, Gansu areas, which are Kham areas. So this led to a lot more restriction from the Chinese side, and there's also a fight of influence between India and China on Nepal. So a lot more restriction in Nepal. So these days we receive between 500 to 600 Tibetans every year. Now this year, the coming in January 2017, we have this religious teaching by His Holiness called the Kala Chakra teaching, the Wheel of Time teaching. And this is considered very sacred, so a lot of Tibetans come. You know, in 2006, some 10,000 Tibetans came from inside Tibet. And the idea, the reason why Chinese allowed so many Tibetans to go at that time was that they thought that maybe His Holiness will say, tell the Tibetans, of course His Holiness keeps saying that, so he would tell the Tibetans that we are not fighting for independence, and, you know, and that might reduce the Tibetans' ability to fight for independence. But on the other hand, of course, apart from this message, there was also a lot of environmental awareness being created by His Holiness. Particularly, Tibetans used to use a lot of animal skins in their dresses as decorations, you know, as piece of ornaments and things like that. And His Holiness asked the Tibetans not to use animal skins, like seal skin or tiger skin, and all that. So all Tibetans inside Tibet started burning all these valuable clothings that they have cultivated over years. And this became a huge disappointment for Chinese government. What they thought and what turned out was totally different, you know. And then the later Kala Chakras, they have been restricting the Tibetans. Like this Kala Chakra, many Tibetans who have passports were taken back by the Chinese authorities. And some of them who managed to travel up to Nepal or to India, now they are being asked to come back before December end, which means they cannot attend the Kala Chakra teachings. If they don't come back on time, they will suffer, their families will suffer. And
when you say suffer, what do you mean?
Or they go through now a lot of punishment. Just on the 8th, another Tibetan from Ngaba area, the Amdo area, which witnessed the largest number of self-immolations so far, Tashi Rabten, 33 years old, he self-immolated on the 8th and he died the next day. He's the 145th Tibetan to self-immolate without even hurting one single Chinese civilian or military, just sacrificing your own life, hoping that the Chinese government will pay some attention to the plight of the Tibetans, or the international community might, you know, pressurize the Chinese government to help resolve the Tibetan issue.
That was my next question. Situation has deteriorated in regards to human rights over the past decades.
I would say Tibet is now, apart from, of course, you have a lot of other situations like Tibet, like North Korea or, you know, certain other countries in the world. But Tibet is certainly, I think the Freedom House called the human rights situation in Tibet as the second worst situation in the world, next to Syria at that time. So Tibet is like a huge prison right now. diplomats, journalists from the free world have no access to Tibet. And even if they are granted access, they are allowed to go to only a few designated areas that Chinese government want to see, or either they are followed or, you know, monitored. So it's a very difficult situation. These testimonies were also made by the United States government, and some of the leading legislators are calling for reciprocal access to Tibet. If you allow Chinese diplomats, or if the Chinese diplomats can come to any part of the United States, then why not the United States diplomats and officials and journalists and ordinary citizens can have access to Tibet? So even for Tibetans, like my friend here, he's a American Tibetan.
Your friend here is in the studio with us.
He is from Portland. I live in his house. He's an American Tibetan. For him to travel to Tibet is a big problem. The Chinese government doesn't issue visa. And even if they do issue, sometimes then they get obstructed at airports, and sometimes they are deported back to United States. You know, just last night I was talking to a group of Tibetans who had similar experiences. So even for American Tibetans, it's not possible to have access to Tibet easily. But some do manage to go, you know. And the situation inside Tibet Autonomous Region is much more stricter, but the regions outside a little more flexible. But even then, it's very difficult, very difficult.
You mentioned His Holiness and his position towards Tibet. He doesn't want Tibet to be necessarily a separate country. Well, what are his interests, and do they parallel the interests of the people of Tibet? I mean, you mentioned that when he said about the animal skins, that everybody did it. So people really follow the Dalai Lama's
That is where
views.
The Chinese government failed to understand the Tibetans. They feel that they brought material development to Tibet. And, you know, for Chinese government to resolve any kind of conflict is development, 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 from a very materialistic point of view. They don't understand the emotional need of the Tibetans, you know, having practiced Buddhism over the last 1,300 years and believing in life after death and so many things, very different from atheist China, who doesn't believe in any kind of religion. That is where they failed. If they managed to address the Tibetan people's need to, you know, go to monasteries and practice their language and religion and culture, I'm sure there would be much more peace in Tibet. Unfortunately, that is not the case. Now, China's policy towards Tibet is very much like the Russian policy towards all its minorities during Soviet Union, you know, providing, of course, the Russian constitution says that the minorities can have the right to self-determination, whereas the Chinese constitution doesn't say that. But they have provided, by in name, some kind of autonomy, whether it's Tibet Autonomous Region or the outside TAR, is the Tibetan Autonomous Prefectures, Tibetan Autonomous Counties, and things like that. But they have recognized that it's all contiguous area inhabited by Tibetans in all these areas. So their policy is assimilation. They bring in more and more Chinese into Tibet. This is the reason why we say we don't have time, because Tibet is huge land-wise, but population is very small, and Chinese population is now, like, I don't know, 1.45 billion people. Mm-hmm. And compared to that, we are nothing. So if you look at the different minorities also, if you look at Manchuria, you hardly find any Manchus who speak the Manchu language. So along with their language, their culture is also gone because everything is being sinicized. Then you have the Inner Mongolians, what China calls as Inner Mongolians, but they themselves like to call them as Southern Mongolians. In Southern Mongolia, out of the 100% population, only 16% are Mongols. And the rest are all Han Chinese, the majority Han Chinese and the Turks. Now in Xinjiang, that's the Uyghur, East Turkestan area, and Tibet, most of the cities and towns are Chinese majority, including the capital of Tibet, Lhasa. You find more Chinese than ever. So wherever they can make money, Chinese move in. And that's how they, you know, the demographic aggression happens. Of course, you know, civilizations have changed, people have evolved and all that, but all these are state-engineered projects, like moving all the Tibetan nomads into compact communities, which makes it easier for them to politically control the Tibetan, because they can't send one Chinese after one Tibetan in the, you know, hills and valleys. So that's how they are trying to change the demography of Tibet, and then they're building more railways, more road networks, more airports, not to bring prosperity for the Tibetans, but for China to gain, you know, take out natural resources, bring in more Chinese into Tibet. So another 30, 40, 50 years down the line, if we are not able to go back with a settlement that is mutually beneficial for the Chinese and the Tibetans, then you might find Tibet towns in Tibet, just like you find Chinese towns in Chinatowns in your country, that Tibetans become completely overwhelmed by a majority Han population. That is the reason why His Holiness, looking at the reality of situation, is not asking for independence, mm-hmm. but autonomy, with rights to preserve its own language, culture, the environment, the religion, and all that, and leave the defense and, you know, foreign policy to China. So that's what we call as the middle way approach, you know, addressing China's sovereignty concerns, but at the same time guaranteeing some kind of rights for the Tibetans to preserve their identity.
You're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm John Shack. My guest is Penpa Sering, the representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. The conversation continues after this on Political Perspectives. This is KBOO. Sting, Send Your Love. I'm speaking with Penpa Sering, elected as the representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, which is based in Washington, D.C. He's in Portland to talk with many Tibetan exiles, about 300, you said, or so, who live in Portland area. The time, obviously, is on China's side. Yes. They're in no rush. They want to keep the situation going and just slowly squeeze you out. So what leverage do you have as the people of Tibet to be able to stop this squeeze? What do you hope to get?
You are right in many ways, but I also like to positively think in other ways. Uh-huh. Sometimes I jokingly tell our Chinese friends, let us see whether the Communist Party of China can outlive the Dalai Lama, or the Dalai Lama can outlive the Chinese Communist Party. Because Chinese Communist Party today is one of the longest autocratic, authoritarian regime in the world. And they have also a lot of internal problems. We know for a fact that the resolution to the Tibet issue can come only from China. But the reason why we are requesting, urging the governments of the United States or Canada or Europe, anybody from the free world to support us, is to push the process faster. But that does not necessarily mean to say that Communist Party will last longer than the Tibetan issue, you know, to be resolved. So we remain positive, we remain hopeful, and we hope that some common sense will come to the Chinese leadership. That the Tibetan issue is one of the easiest issue to be resolved. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is the key to resolving the Tibetan issue, because he is still in good health. He's 81, going to be 82, and he has promised to live up to 100. So there's still another, 20, 30 years down the line. maybe he will not be physically that much capable as he is right now, but then he is one person who can convince the Tibetans inside Tibet that this is the best solution for China and for the Tibetan people. You know, so if China doesn't take this up, one can't imagine. You already have 145 Tibetans who self-immolated, who burned themselves to death. And if this Dalai Lama has to die in exile, what could be the emotional reaction inside Tibet? Will that help heal the wounds between the Chinese leadership or the government and the Tibetan people? Or rather, would it make it worse? And under circumstances where, because China is already has passed laws, atheist government who doesn't believe in any kind of religion, they want to be responsible for the final authorization of recognition of reincarnated lamas inside Tibet.
Yeah, they want to be able to have some religious influence, even though they don't care about religion. Of course, it's political, right?
Yeah,
in fact, they've kidnapped the next Panchen Lama at 5 years old, and nobody knows. Talk a little bit about that.
We still don't know. The 10th Panchen Lama died in 1989 after he was incarcerated for a very long time under house arrest, detention, torture, and all that till Mao Zedong died in 1976. Then he was released, and then he played some very positive role inside Tibet, you know, bringing back Tibetan language as the core and the medium of learning in Northeast Tibet, and he wanted to spread it out. But then, unfortunately, a lot of events leading up to his death in 1989, coinciding also with Tiananmen Square massacre and all that. So he died in 1989 under very suspicious circumstances. We still don't know whether he was poisoned or he had a natural death. And then his reincarnation, the Chinese government formed a team to recognize his reincarnation, led by Chajit Rinpoche, who's an abbot of the Teshe Lhubu monastery that Panchen Lama belongs traditionally. And this Rinpoche, Chajit Rinpoche, has also been in touch with His Holiness' office regarding the selection of possible candidates. And then His Holiness did his divinations and found that this young boy, Gendu Chuyinima, is the real reincarnation of the 10th Panchen Lama. And His Holiness announced this internationally, and Chinese government didn't like it at all, and then they denounced that, and they followed their own procedure, which supposedly the Chinese Qing Emperor in 1793 in one of their edicts has made it made a system to selection through the golden urn. The names of possible candidates are put there, but what we recognize from that selection process is that they have pushed the name that they want selected, because actually they put form under that name, which comes out by itself after some time, you know. So the Lama had to select that because of pressure from the Chinese government. So they chose Gansen Nobu, who's different. We don't even know the boy selected by His Holiness and also concurred by the leader of the selection committee. His name was there or not, but among other names, this boy's name was taken, and the other boy recognized by His Holiness Dalai Lama with his family disappeared at the age of 6.
Nobody has any idea where he might be.
Nobody has any idea.
Or if he's still alive.
Yeah, we still don't know whether he's alive or not, and if he's alive, the Chinese government always says he's alive, he's studying, he's getting good education, and he doesn't want to be disturbed, and so nobody knows.
He would be about 25 now.
He must be about now
1996, 20, you said?
Yeah, 27, 28
okay.
Years old. So they put their own Panchen Lama on the Tibetans, who's not respected by any Tibetans in Tibet. The last time we heard, he gave a Kala Chakra teaching, and Tibetans were forced to attend that teaching. Even if you go to Lhasa today, you won't see the picture of the pension that was selected by the Chinese government, you will see only pictures of the 10th pension lama, because they are not allowed to sell pictures of the pension lama selected by His Holiness. So that is the reaction from the Tibetan side. So even if they choose a next Dalai Lama, now what kind of emotional outbreak this can cause with the Tibetans inside Tibet? Right? It's not just the Tibetans inside Tibet. His Holiness' legacy has extended beyond that. You have the Buddhists in Kalmyk, Tuwa, Buryat in Russian republics, then you have the Mongolia, then you have Indians in the Himalayan belt who are culturally very close to Tibetans. Then these days you have so many groups coming from Japan, from Taiwan, Singapore, Vietnam, all these Buddhist countries, and you know how much followers he has.
I was just going to say that. I mean, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is probably one of the most respected people on the planet. Mm. I mean, he comes and meets and writes and talks and offers so much hope to the whole world itself. I'm speaking with Penpa Tsering, representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet in Washington, D.C. And you spoke on December 7th to the Congressional Executive Commission on China on Capitol Hill, outlining some of the desires of the Dalai Lama for the United States government. Of course, we've gone through now an election. We have new president, new Congress coming up. What does the Dalai Lama make of our new president-elect, Donald Trump? And what's the situation with the U.S. president so far? Has it been positive? Have they been dragging their feet?
No, since 1991, since George Bush Sr., all the presidents of the United States have been meeting with His Holiness. In mm-hmm. fact, with President George Bush Jr. and President Barack Obama, they had met at least four times during their tenure as President of the United States. And we have no bias, of course. We are bipartisan. When it comes to the issue of Tibet, we have support both from Republicans and Democrats, from Senate to House, you know, mm-hmm. so it's bicameral, bipartisan, and we have never taken any sides during the election, aside from what the American Tibetans think. So I have not asked any of them as to who they voted, but it's not my job to do so. And we have good relations with both the Republicans and the Democrats. And in fact, when President Bush was there, the 2002 U.S.-Tibet policy was passed, and also with Democratic majority in the House. Nancy Pelosi, Senator Feinstein, they were all big supporters. The Congressional Gold Medal was conferred on His Holiness. So His Holiness is not overtly concerned about what might happen, because you have a very good system in place. America is a place where everybody has their own stake. They are leaders, but leaders alone cannot take all the decisions. Mm-hmm. Election is one thing. Election, during elections, a lot of rhetorics happen and all that. But when it comes to the ground of handling situations on the ground, then you have to face reality. You can't just be flying over the top. So we are not overtly fearful that something very wrong thing might happen. You have a very active media, which trails every single minute, every step of the way, whether things are going right or wrong. You have huge public debates and, public opinion, people coming on streets peacefully if they have any, expressions to be made. So that way, His Holiness is not overtly concerned. He believes that President-elect Trump will carry through his job responsibly. And he looks forward to meeting with the president.
Is there any indication from President-elect Trump that he will meet with the Dalai Lama? Have you received any communication from him?
Right now, our office had no connection with the transition team so far. And of course, we can't reach President-elect as of now. They are all so busy with the transition, positioning people in different posts. We're also looking at who could be the next Secretary of State and the Under Secretary, and just as I mentioned before, who could be the person responsible for coordinating on the Tibetan issues that's mandated by the U.S. Tibet Policy Act of 2002.
So what are the things that you'd like the incoming administration as well as Congress to do officially?
So the ultimate aim of the Tibetan, of His Holiness Dalai Lama and the Tibetans in exile is to resolve the Tibet issue peacefully, non-violently, for a mutually beneficial solution both for China and for Tibetans. So this is what we need the U.S. government to impress upon the Chinese leadership, that this is good for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a win-win situation, that there should be a resumption of dialogue between the representative of His Holiness Dalai Lama and the Chinese government. So this is the key thing. So before that happens, it's important that we send the right signals. So the President-elect Trump wants his once he takes over the presidency to meet with His Holiness as early as an opportunity provides. This will also send a right signal that he's concerned about the Tibetan issue, and also keeping good relations with a world religious leader, who has credibility of thinking of the good of all humanity. I think that will also bode well for President Trump and his persona. So then, of course, we want the U.S. government and the Congress to continue implementing the 2002 U.S. Tibet Policy Act by appointing special the coordinator for Tibet in the State Department.
I want to stop for a second, because this in 2002 to do that, they made the decision, but they have never implemented that.
No, they have. That's why we have an undersecretary in the State Department on for global affairs, human rights, a lot of responsibilities, but also at the same time responsible as special coordinator for Tibetan issue. So as of today, we have Undersecretary Sarah Sewell as the special coordinator, and I had the opportunity of meeting her on October 21st, and then on 6th of this month, just before coming to Portland, I met her with several people from like-minded countries, embassies, people from embassies of like-minded countries to work on the Tibet issue together. So it really helps us. We don't need to go to each and every single department individually, but through that office, we can reach out to all others, including humanitarian aid for the Tibetans. So this is important. They also submit a negotiations report on the status of negotiation between China and Tibet from the State Department to the Congress every year. And this other thing, the Congressional Executive Committee on China, that came as an offshoot after China became a member of the World Trade Organization, and then they signed a pact on free trade between U.S. and China. That mandated human rights not to be separated from business. That's why you have the Congressional Economic Cooperation, Executive Commission on China, that reports in detail, from the Congress side to the administration as well as the Congress as to what the administration and the Congress should be doing. So these are some of the things. These are unbiased reporting by the U.S. government as to what is going on in China, what is going on in Tibet, in Uyghur, in Inner Mongolia, in Hong Kong, in a whole lot of issues that concerns U.S. As a policy on human rights, religious freedom, all that. So these are important for us, apart from we saying it. When we say it, it might be looked upon as a propaganda, just like Chinese government is saying so many lies. But we always check facts whenever we come out with something. But the United States government doing it and saying it is a different matter.
Right. So what allies do you have in the U.S. Congress?
We don't look at individual. We work mostly with the foreign relations committees of the both the House and the Senate, with staff force and leaders.
Mm-hmm.
We also work with the CECC, just like this hearing where Chris Smith is the chair and Senator Rubio is the co-chair, and they are also very concerned members in the committee, like Congressman Hultman and Walz, who were present there during the hearing. And we also reach out to the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission, as the Congressman Jim McGovern has been a very active member in that. Then you also have Congressman Joe Pitts, who's resigning by January 2nd, but he has always been very helpful. A new chairman will come in place. And then we also work with the Appropriations Committee. It's not possible with our very limited resources. Office of Tibet works with International Campaign for Tibet. Together, they have some resources and experience. And we reach out to as many members from these different committees, which has direct link with the Tibet issue.
And one final question. We're just about out of time. Penpa Sering is speaking with me. He's the representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. What can U.S. citizens, so those hearing this broadcast today who are interested in the plight of justice and the people of Tibet, what can you say to them? What would you like? How can they help?
If you love freedom, if you love democracy, if you love justice, then please help us. We don't have all of this. Even though Tibet may be remote, you might feel that Tibet is far off from you and may not be connected directly. But we all must understand in this globalized world that everything is interdependent. Any small event in one part of the world affects the other. The more you make an authoritarian regime stronger by kowtowing, bending to them, to their wills, to their commands, then they become much more bolder. So when governments will do whatever they can at their level, but government will react to its people's wishes, because people decide who should be in the government. So every single American counts, whether it's to do with Tibet, or Uyghur, or Inner Mongolia, or Chinese people in China, or whether it's Korean people in North Korea, or whether it's people in the Middle East who are going through a lot of suffering. So anybody who is suffering and anybody who is denied or devoid of all these freedoms, please help guarantee this, because every single person's voice matters. Thank you.
Thank you. Penpa Sering, he is the representative for the Dalai Lama at the State Department, recently elected to this position and taking it over. It's very important and a delight to meet you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much. And good to be in touch with people in Portland. Please support us. Thank you.
You've been listening to Political Perspectives. My guest has been Penpa Sering, who was in Portland over the weekend, visiting with members of the Tibetan community in Portland. Penpa Sering is the representative of His Holiness the Dalai Lama at the Office of Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. I'm John Schott for KBOO.